What sparked your passion for cooking?
I have a good appetite and I eat.
I'll often make subtle changes to the next batch of it.
As long as it has room to move around, it's classified as free range.
So my mother gave me a crash course in cookery when I was 16.
I remember sampling this amazing drink, thinking how I've never tasted coffee this good.
Which homemade desserts can be cheaper than shop-bought alternatives?
We want people to feel at home.
It's just gone 12 o'clock and you're listening to Flavour on Cambridge 105 with Matt Bentman, Ruth Reyes and Alan Alder. And we're back after a month's break following the coverage of the Cambridge Film Festival.
On the programme today, we look at diets and find out what people on the street think of them. And we speak with the dietitian from Adam Brooks for a better understanding of losing weight.
And we also have a welcome additional wine and music feature from Tom Lewis. We've all heard of red and white wines, but orange wines? Stay tuned to find out all about them.
Tom Lewis will also be recommending his wines of the month, and there are some really interesting ones in his list. And we'll be finding out some interesting news about Matt and Ruth and their work outside the programme.
And we'll also be having Cambridge's food news, and we'll be rounding off the programme with our review of the best food and drink items from today's newspapers.
Okay, so I don't know about you, but I've always felt that diets are such an ingrained in our culture. From Atkins and the Cambridge diet some years ago, to the latest of these super popular diets, which is the 5-2. I think as people, we're big fans of the get thin quick idea, and the 5-2 diet has been featured all over the place in the last few weeks, and I feel like I can't get away.
Could you explain the 5-2 diet a little bit more to us?
Yeah, well, basically, it consists of 2 starve days, no need to be consecutive, and the 5 normal eating days. On the starve days, you have to stick within a 500 calorie parameter for women and 600 calorie for men, which is not a lot. And basically, you can eat whatever you want on the other 5 days, and also known as intermittent fasting. I mean, I don't diet. I'm of the eat less, move more school of thought, but loads of people I know do. 4 of the 6 people in my office are currently on the 5-2, and several people I know are doing diets like the paleo diet and the vegan before 6, which seems to be all over my Twitter feed. But it's this fascination with diets that something really so common. Are these just extra strange circumstances that I find myself in? I mean, I took to the streets to see what people thought of dieting in general.
Personally, it's never worked for me.
Okay.
I'm much more of a balanced person. I like to exercise, and I find that that's really the best thing that works.
In general, I always like feeling concerned about my figures. To be honest, I don't want to lose much weight. I just want to be healthy. Diet for me is like I want to having balanced lifestyle, exercise. I'm not like negative for my figure now. I'm quite positive for my figure. It's all about my inside, you know. I feel happy, I feel positive. Yeah, confidence.
I think you shouldn't do anything extreme, but having a healthy diet is good for a person.
Dieting shouldn't be something you do to get quick results. I don't really believe in having a diet. I believe in having a healthy lifestyle. So it's actually something I do every day rather than a quick fix. I mean, I'm 26. It took me 26 years to get to this shape. It's going to take me a little bit longer to get to the shape I want to be rather than just overnight. So no, I don't believe in quick fixes or anything like that. I think it should be an ongoing lifestyle.
There's a lot of fads and they're quite extreme.
I think you should just enjoy life, and if food is something to enjoy as it is for most people, then you shouldn't diet. Just do more exercise.
I agree. I'm all for exercise, eat what you want, obviously in moderation, but I think dieting creates a bad relationship with food, and that's kind of like will ultimately affect the way you perceive food generally, and you have to eat 3 times a day, so why are you going to kind of like create a
negative?
Yeah, exactly. It's not worth it. So, and enjoy food, it's so nice.
Since the 5-2 is the more prominent diet du jour, from what I can tell, I felt I should ask people if they knew about it and what they thought, and the results were surprising.
Have you heard about the 5-2 diet?
No.
Okay, it's basically a diet where you starve yourself for 2 days, and the rest of the 5 days you can eat normally. So what do you think about that?
I don't think that would work, because it's stupid.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, the 5 days eat what you want and 2 days fasting.
That's correct.
Yes.
What's your opinion on that?
I am undecided at this moment in time. I understand some of the science behind it, that it's supposed to mimic what humans did years and years and years ago, but I don't know if it's going to go the way of the Atkins diet and then 10 years' time everyone goes, actually, we've just given ourselves loads of health problems. I prefer to just eat clean and keep it to wholesome foods, to fruits, vegetables, nuts, seeds, things that I know aren't processed. But I'm on the fence with the 5-2 diet. I'm not quite sure.
Okay. Is that the one where you fast 2 days a week?
Yeah, that's the one. What do you think about that?
I only just came from New Zealand and I only just heard about it this past week. It seems very extreme.
My mother-in-law does it and she's usually miserable by the end of the day.
Oh, no.
And, I'm not going to say I haven't thought about doing it, because I have. I just think that if you need to starve yourself for 2 days, then picking out the other five aren't really going to work.
Do you know how your mother-in-law's finding it?
I think she dropped it.
So there we are, not quite as popular as I was thinking, and yet I still hear about it or see something about it daily. Maybe it's one of those things where, you know, someone points it out to you once and all you can do is just keep noticing it. Or is it just me? I mean, I don't know. Sadly, none of the people I know who are on the 5-2 diet wanted to speak to us, so I had to do a little trial myself.
So, how did it go?
Not very well. Like I said, I don't really diet, and like most people, I get really unpleasantly grumpy when I'm hungry, and I found it really hard to concentrate, function, anything on a starve day. And also, I had to count everything and its calorific value and the, you know, whether it's good calories or bad calories, I don't know, I'm not a fan. But there were 5 apps that could log me in, and I could log in what I was eating, and then they calculate it. And the number of diet apps is also equally as astounding, and it was interesting to try it nonetheless, just to see what it's all about really. And just, I actually got quite a few good few recipes.
Oh, right. Well, maybe we can share those recipes next time, Ruth. The 5-2 ratio, though, is being used on lots of other things as well, like not drinking alcohol for 2 days a week. And, of course, the week is divided for most people into 5 working days and 2 days off, so it does seem to be a workable ratio. But, Matt, you spoke with Helen Davis from Addenbrooke some time ago about dieting, didn't you?
Yeah, I sought out Helen, a dietitian, to see what they can do and what they can offer us.
It's a blisteringly hot day, and I am speaking with dietitian Helen Davis. Helen, welcome to Flavour on Cambridge 105.
Hello.
Helen, what does a dietitian do exactly?
Many people ask that question, and they also ask what's the difference between a dietitian and a nutritionist. So dieticians specialise in...
What's the difference between a dietitian and a nutritionist?
So it's important to say that dieticians, it's a legally protected title. Mm-hmm. So you have to have certain educational credentials to be registered as a dietitian. A nutritionist isn't a legally protected title within the UK at the moment. So somebody could become a nutritionist from a weekend course or a 4-year degree.
Okay.
So it's very hard to standardise. As a dietitian, we spend most of our time helping with treating people with certain diseases, people that perhaps want to lose weight, gain weight, get ready for operations in hospital. So we try and optimise health by making sure that people eat and drink as well as they can do.
Is that where dietitians are found largely, in hospitals, or do they crop up in other avenues of life?
Dietitians do get everywhere. So we have lots of dietitians that work within the NHS, within hospitals, within the hospital setting. You'll also get community dietitians that work out amongst the GP practices, and you'll also get dietitians who may work freelance through private clinics. They work independently, and sports dietetics is also an up-and-coming area, so there'll be a dietitian linked to a local sports club or a more elite institution.
And what was the attraction for you? I mean, did you know for a very young age that you wanted to be a dietitian?
Funnily enough, no. I mean, often dietetics tends to be something specialised in, perhaps when people have done an undergrad degree in something more broad, say something like biology or sports science is another common avenue that people come down. For me personally, I actually decided to be a dietitian at 18 before I went to university. Mm. And I think it was my love of food, my passion for staying healthy, fit and healthy, and eating well and drinking well and enjoying food as much as possible, I think is very important. So I'd like to help others do the same.
So how would I get to see a dietitian?
Do you feel that you need one, Matt?
Right now, yes. And just handily, I seem to be in a room with one.
Yeah,
so that's
yeah. So, as I said earlier, dietitians work in lots of different places. So if you were a patient at a hospital and you decided that you'd like to see a dietitian to try and help whatever condition you're struggling with, then often speaking to your consultant is a good place to start, and they can refer you down the line. More commonly, if you're not a patient in a secondary care hospital, then approaching your GP in your local practice should be a good place to start, so you'll be able to be referred to a dietitian there. Alternatively, there are lots of freelance dietitians out there too, so perhaps either asking your local practice or searching online in a reputable site would also point you in the right direction.
Here's a good question, and it's an old adage. Is there any truth to this, right? Someone told me years ago, eat breakfast like a prince, lunch like a king, and tea like a pauper. Do you agree with that?
I think eating a good breakfast is a very good start to the day. Eating breakfast like a prince, are we talking in terms of quantity or in terms of quality?
Quality and quantity. So I'm always imagining in my head, decent sized breakfast, the lunch is the biggest meal, dinner is just light and something that doesn't sit on your stomach when you go to bed.
I would say it's more to do with the total amount of energy you're eating in the day. Some people skip breakfast, and that means that they're more likely to snack on things as they go through the morning. So they may grab a chocolate bar mid-morning because they missed breakfast and they're absolutely starving.
Yeah.
So actually, it's probably a better approach to have smaller, frequent meals throughout the day. Three average meals a day is a good place to start. Given that most of us don't do enough exercise, eating breakfast like a prince may mean that you're eating more than you actually need, and the likelihood that you're actually going to burn that off over the day is probably unlikely when we work in an environment of sitting down, getting the car to work. And some people find that if they eat too late at night, then they find it hard to sleep because eating raises your metabolism. But again, it's finding a balance that suits you and your lifestyle, and it's far better to get three average healthy meals in the day than worrying too much about having a giant breakfast and then a tiny dinner later on.
With lifestyles in mind, this would take me on to my next question about dieting. Do you think they're rather self-defeating? I mean, I have in my head that they are something, they're just designed for something with a beginning and an end. It's a program to follow, but then once the program is over, the pressure is off. I just found that I know lots of people who have trouble once the program is over, everything reverts back. I mean, do you find that they cause more problems than they solve?
No, I wouldn't say that. Most people that I see in a weight loss clinic will have tried several commercial diets in the past, and it's getting to the bottom of why they failed to maintain that diet in the first place. So often it involves a lot of soul searching, and was the diet they tried too radical for them? Was it unrealistic to maintain? And that's often a more important thing to consider rather than just following the diet, like you say, with a start and an end point. And if it's solely that diet that motivates them to be able to stick on the straight and narrow, then that's something they need to address themselves.
Okay.
So for some people they work, and for some people they're life-changing and they manage to maintain their weight loss, and for other people, like you say, they yo-yo diet, they come on and off the diet several times in their life but never actually getting to the root cause of where the problems lie in the first place.
Yeah, always the root cause is always the person's self-motivation and whatever else is going on in their lives.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay, well, here's another question then, because I've had this posed to me, and it's all about eating and exercise. If you eat and then you exercise, or vice versa, does it make any difference? I mean, is the only consideration how much you eat and exercise in, say, a 24-hour period?
I would say that how regularly you exercise has the biggest impact. For some people that take their training very seriously, then it's very important to balance out exactly when they're getting their carbohydrates and proteins and fluids and all the other important aspects of sports nutrition. For Joe Bloggs trying to lose weight and just to exercise regularly, then it's really picking a time of day that would suit them and which is most conducive for them to be able to maintain that level of exercise. Some people like to exercise before they have breakfast and then have breakfast, and there's no real difference between doing that than having their breakfast first and then exercising.
So there's no tried and trusted rule that you would say, because I've tried both, and I think I generally tend to prefer eating afterwards. Yeah, that's just me though, but everybody is different, because I've known other people that where I've joined a group for a little while and they've done the opposite and they find it works for them.
Yeah, some people can't think about doing anything before they've had their breakfast or before they've eaten something. And it's important to remember that eating gives you the energy that you need in order to carry out your day-to-day activities. And if you're highly active or you're training each day or going to the gym every day, it's very important that you stay well-nourished and hydrated. So it's important to consider your nutrition around your exercise. In terms of calorie burning and things like that, then I would say probably it's more the total amount of exercise you're doing, balancing with your total intake of energy, that makes the real difference.
And this is perhaps somewhat slightly outside the remit of a food program, but how closely would you say the role of dietitian is linked with counselling? Like, how often do you find that the dietary habit is an indicator to a deeper emotional symptom? Does it become a multidisciplinary case at that point?
Definitely, and increasingly now when dietitians are training to become qualified, we try and make sure that people are aware of the different triggers to eating. So for a lot of people, they will either eat when they're happy, eat when they're sad, eat when they're depressed. Some people may go to the gym when they're feeling stressed, other people might reach for a Mars bar. So we're very aware, and yes, we do a lot of CBT counselling and things like that in training, and then we refer on to psychologists and things if it's something that we can't deal with ourselves.
So it's something that you naturally look for when you first see a new client?
Yes.
Yeah. Just to end on a slightly more light-hearted note, do dietitians practice what they preach?
Well, I'd hate to speak for the other hundreds of dietitians that are out there, but like I said at the beginning, in order to become a dietitian, you do need a passion for food and enjoy your food and enjoy eating and drinking healthily. So personally, I would say that I'm into fitness and eating well, but I like a piece of chocolate cake and a glass of wine on a Friday night. We are human.
Yeah.
but I wouldn't like to speak for everyone there.
Okay. What's your favourite dinner, Helen?
My favourite dinner would be macaroni and cheese, which I know there'll be a sharp intake of breath out there. Just like when I go to a restaurant and order a dessert. People are fascinated with what we eat.
Cauliflower cheese as well, or strictly macaroni? Yeah, macaroni and cheese.
Well, cauliflower is one of your five a day, so because I'm on air, I have to say that yes, I do like cauliflower cheese as well.
Well, Helen, it's been a pleasure chatting with you. Thanks for agreeing to this interview. And once again, you're listening to Flavour on Cambridge 105.
Thank you.
Helen Davis, dietitian, and I apologise for my myopic views on diets in that piece. They can be a great benefit for many people, and I'm also sorry if my tone seemed quite belittling. It's all about the motivation, it would seem. Adopting good habits can take a lifetime, but a bad habit can be created in a second. Helen also talked quite emphatically about other aspects of a dietitian's job that didn't feature in this interview, such as how they deal with people struggling with diseases that impact upon their ability to eat, such as a serious allergy, or people who have had portions of their gut removed. The key point is that dietitians spend a lot of their time helping people managing their special diets.
And if you'd like to send us your thoughts on diets, the 5-2, etc., what diets have you been trying, have tried, we'll share some next time. Whether successes or failures, you can contact us on flavour@cambridge105.fm.
It's the show that takes you home, 105 Drive, Monday to Friday from 4. There's the news, national and local, plus the weather, sport, entertainment and that all-important travel every half hour. We speak to the people who make Cambridge, actors, musicians, politicians, fundraisers, community leaders, people like you.
I'm joined by my two guests this evening. They are Emily Dunning, she's the manager at the Cambridge Hub, also Lucy Binfield, who is the editor of a new publication we're going to talk about called The Ethical Guide to Cambridge. Good afternoon to you both. Thank you for coming in.
Hello.
Hello.
And here to talk about all of that is Terry Holloway, is the Group Support Executive of the Marshall Group of Companies. Hello, Terry. Thanks for coming in.
It's lovely to be here, and thanks for playing such a terrific piece of music.
It's all wrapped up with the best in music that spans the decades. That's 105 Drive with me, Julian Clover, Monday to Friday from 4 p.m. on Community Radio in your city, Cambridge 105.
For the last few editions of Flavour, our wine critic Tom Lewis has been providing some very interesting pieces that show how the characteristics of wine can be illustrated through music. The piece in our previous programme was supposed to be the last, but we're pleased to say we have one more. And we've included rather more of the music in this feature. Tom, welcome back on the wine and music analogies front, which has been, I think, really quite groundbreaking and has
good. We like groundbreaking.
provoked a lot of interest. So let's see if we can milk some more out of it.
I'm up for that.
Right. What about different sorts of wines, orange wines, natural wines?
Yeah, so if I talk a little bit about this, orange wines was a term that was invented about 10 years ago, and they are they're white wines that are made as if they were red, so they're left on the skins for an extended period. So normally with a white wine, you crush the grapes, take the juice and ferment it. And for a red wine, you'll leave the grapes in there, and that's where the colour and the flavour comes from. So if you use that red wine method of leaving the grapes whole for an extended period, but you do it with white wine grapes, say a Riesling or Chardonnay, that the end result is somewhere halfway between the two, and that's an orange wine. An orange wine's a part of a more general movement of a sort of a kind of almost a back to basics, natural wines and biodynamics. So again, in the scale of things, the basic level is organic wine, which is just not using pesticides and artificial fertilisers. And I think that can only be a good thing. Biodynamics takes it the next step up into what some people would say is a little bit of mumbo jumbo, and that's using things like the phases of the moon, or the one I always like is burying a cow horn full of dung at the end of a row of vines to promote the fertility of the vines. It's all a bit pagan and you know, bearded and sandal wearing and that kind of thing. And then, you know, take it even a step further and you're into natural wines. And natural wines are, you know, that's the kind of person who has a beard and doesn't wear any deodorant. it says, you know, I am completely natural. I have no sulfur. I just use the grapes.
So those wines don't have added sulfites?
No added sulfites. Right.
That causes some people difficulties, isn't it? You know, people seem to get headaches and some people seem to be sensitive to the sulfites.
I think, yes. I mean, there are all sorts of things you can add to wine to make it, to refine it. And natural wines say, you know, hey, let's get rid of all of that. Let's move back to a much more innocent age and you know, no additives at all. And there is a natural amount of sulfur on the grapes themselves. So as long as everything is absolutely squeaky clean in your process, then the wine itself will not spoil. But you know, these are not wines for long aging because they're just not they're not well preserved.
Right, and I'm wondering who the musical analogy, which musician is famed for not wearing deodorant?
Well, not so much on the deodorant side, but for me, all of this movement, all of these wines are very different. You know, there are recognisable elements there, but they take things that are sort of maybe considered to be not part of that you try and get rid of, and they say this is what's great about it. So for me, the music analogy here has to be Frank Zappa.
Right, well, that's an odd piece of music, Tom. But you know, there are some recognisable sort of elements to it, aren't there?
Yeah, well, exactly. That's sort of what I'm thinking of. So that was Frank Zappa. It's from his album Joe's Garage, and that one is the first track. It's called The Central Scrutinizer. And yes, I'd agree. It's a little bit weird and unsettling. But it is fundamentally recognisable as music and as something quite tuneful. So that's sort of the idea I had for this analogy, that it's... it's a bit strange. It probably took a little bit of getting used to, but it is recognisable.
And have you got used to these wines?
Natural wines are an interesting area. You have to have absolute squeaky cleanness in the production process for them to work. And I think within natural wines is where they have the biggest range of quality, because issues can come in much more easily than if the wine is more industrially produced. So that's the trade-off. So when they're really well done, natural wines are absolutely lovely, and they have, you know, a bit like we heard in that music, a sort of an intensity and a slight strangeness that's fascinating. But, you know, a little bit like Frank Zappa himself, you know, some of their stuff is dire, and you wouldn't want to drink it in the same way that, you know, you wouldn't want to listen to it. It's not great.
Right. Is it more expensive because it has to be so carefully made? Does that make it more expensive than
I think an equivalent? It's probably... It's not as easy to get hold of. I mean, this isn't $3.99 supermarket wine. Mm. It's not produced in bulk. It's more artisan. So I think it's the processes probably make it a little bit more expensive. But in any case, you know, if a non-natural wine was made to that level of quality, that would be of an equivalent price. So I don't think it makes it's in a different league. We can say, to the sort of, as I say, supermarket wines. And the issue with natural wines, I think, always is, you know, you need a reliable guide to pick the good ones. I think if you just try at random, you risk, a bit like if you picked a Frank Zappa album at random, you wouldn't be sure of getting
the
good
one.
Yes,
you wouldn't know what you'd end up with, actually, would you? They're quite varied. And do any of the Cambridge wine merchants have natural wines?
The best place to go to for natural wines would be to Joseph Barnes in Saffron Walden. So he's a specialist in Languedoc, southern France, and he also does northern Spain. And down there, because it's an area that's reinventing itself, they're very interested in organics, biodynamics, and natural wines. So if that's an area of interest, definitely go to Joseph Barnes and chat with Charles Hardcastle there.
Right. Let's move on to Jura wines, because they're quite interesting, Tom, aren't they?
Well, Jura, again, is perhaps an area that people aren't particularly familiar with. And so let me just start by explaining where it is and what the wines are like. Jura is in eastern France, and it gives us the word Jurassic. So the hills there, they're not part of the Alps. It's the Jura Mountains. And the soil type is Jurassic. It's due east of Burgundy, and so it uses a lot of the Burgundian grapes. They have Chardonnay and Pinot Noir, plus some relatively obscure local grapes. Now, the thing with Jura wines is everything you ever thought of about wine, take the opposite, and that's Jura. So the white wines are heavier than the reds. The reds are very light, very lots of ripe fruit, but not a lot of tannins in them. So they're almost like rosés, whereas the whites are aged in oak, often for multiple years. So they're much bigger. So if you were tasting Jura wines, you'd start with the reds and then move on to the whites. The other thing is that the whites are made with exposure to air. So they're done in a sort of... oxidized way, and again, normally when you're making wine, if you want it to be squeaky clean with lots of fruit, you'll minimize the air contact completely. In Jura, the tradition is for the wines to be aged actually in contact with air, but it's done in a controlled way so that they don't go off or go bad. But what they do is they lose the overt fruit and they gain in a sort of texture and sort of underpinnings. So again, they're quite challenging wines and very different from you know, what is the tradition and what one might be used to.
I'm surprised that they don't change into the alcohol doesn't carry on fermenting and become an aldehyde or a... acetic acid or something like that.
Well, they'll age them for a number of years. They don't, once they've finished fermenting, then they're just a bit like a sherry left in contact with the air. And they have their own version of sherry, which is called vin jaune. And the same thing that happens in sherry there, that the a yeast, a flour, grows on top. So that will keep some of the air out of touch with the wine. So, but it'll give it its own flavour. And that's aged for 6 years. And it gives it a sort of pungent sharpness that really is quite challenging. But once you've got used to it, is fans of it, I absolutely love it.
And are these available locally?
Jura is starting to get there. I mean, historically, even a couple of years ago, you would probably struggle to find even one or two examples in Cambridge. And you know, as you know, we have seven independent wine merchant outlets in the city centre. For some reason, New York has really taken to Jura wines, and they've become really popular with sommeliers, and then from there, you know, they now have a sort of almost a cult following. And I think the winemakers of Jura have seen the success that they've had in New York and said, well, let's try and replicate this elsewhere in the world. So for the first time this year, about 30 winemakers came over to London with six of their wines each for a full-on trade tasting of Jura wines. That's never happened before. So it is sort of on a roll. I think it's something that's interesting. If you're a fan of something different and unusual, they're going to get increasingly easier to find. It's a little bit like, you know, we were talking earlier about, you know, going to early punk gigs before it broke, or in my case, you know, sort of grunge before that hit the mainstream. And it's a little bit like at that stage. It's a bit like seeing, you know, Dr. Feelgood or you know, Nirvana before they got big.
Right. I can't imagine what the musical analogy is going to be.
Well, for me, Jura wines, I've gone with prog rock, so that sort of 70s sort of cerebral style of rock. And the reasons for that are, you know, prog is, it's unfashionable and it takes a bit of getting used to, and it has a sort of cerebral interest. You can understand it before you enjoy it, and it takes time to learn to enjoy it. Jura wines, they're more about the texture and the structure. That there isn't that immediately obvious, easy to enjoy fruit.
So the music?
The music I've chosen, Close to the Edge.
Yes, a small part of Close to the Edge.
Yep, it's 18 minutes long, so we haven't quite got time for the whole thing.
and not a band I was ever terribly keen on,
actually.
Were you
not a fan?
No, I didn't really like John Anderson's vocals terribly much, so...
He's got that... his style is quite angelic and choir boy, and it's different, and that's sort of part of the reason why I chose this. I remember listening to this with a couple of friends, and my friend was... he was a huge Yes fan, and the other guy in the room said, this sounds like someone's just locked them all in a room and said, play your instruments as loudly as possible, but without any recognition of what anyone else is doing. And I think is that the impression you get?
Yes, it is. I think that's exactly the impression I've got, yes.
And that's sort of... it is a bit disorientating, but actually it is, you know, it's the music's been written, it's offbeat, but it's all in time, and it, you know, dare I say it, a couple more listenings and you'll decide whether you like it or not, but it's, the initial impression is, what's going on here? This is not what I'm used to. That's the same with Jura wines, I think. You know, people say you have to spend a couple of days in the region, even before, you know, you get anywhere close to sort of making sense of the wines.
A bit like going to the vast open areas of the United States and then suddenly realising why they like country music, you know, because it's of the area
of its place.
Yeah.
So lock yourself in a room with the entire Yes collection, which will probably take you several days to listen to. And if you're not climbing up the walls by the end of it, you may find you've liked it.
And that was Tom Lewis. And you can find all the previous episodes in Tom's Wine and Music series on the Flavour Podcasts. There's a link to them on the Cambridge 105 website.
And Tom's just come into the studio, and in a few minutes' time, he'll give us his wine recommendations for October.
Today's Jazz on Jazz Today. Join me, Pete Butchers, for 2 hours of the best in contemporary improvised sounds. Alternate Sundays at 4, here on Cambridge 105, community radio in your city.
OK, let's move on to some food news now. Eat Cambridge, the food and drink festival, is running from the 10th to the 24th of May next year. Now, the main event, where lots of independent producers display their products, will happen on the 17th. And anyone wanting to host a fringe event, and they take place on the 24th, or who wishes to volunteer to help the festival team, can email them at hello@eat-cambridge.co.uk. Now, that's hello as in H-E-L-L-O, not hello. Or any other variation of
hello.
Hello. You can keep up to date with the news about the festival from the website eat-cambridge.co.uk. And, of course, here on Cambridge 105, we'll be keeping you posted with regular updates.
And news from Noel Young Wine Merchants in Trumpington. Next Saturday, they have an in-store tasting all day, and it's free. And it includes new wines from the Weingut-Wieninger Winery in Vienna. And these are all wines from 2012, wines that Tom Lewis has mentioned before, like Gruner Veltliners, Rieslings, Gelber, Muscatella, and the unique Gemischter Satzfeld blends, plus the new 2012 Gruner Veltliners from Kurt Angerer, along with his best reds ever from the 2012 vintage. And not only that, but their Christmas tasting is taking place on the 14th of November at Anstey Hall in Trumpington. It runs from 6 to 9:30pm, and you're free to wander about sampling the wines. You can call to book your place on Cambridge 566 744, and you might like to mention that you heard about it on Flavour.
Also, in the drinks line, there's a remarkable story about Cambridge colleges swapping £10,000 worth of port from up to 50 years ago with Cambridge wine merchants. This is in exchange for some of the 2011 vintage, which is said to be an unusually good quality, though it may not reach its best for up to another 50 years. The result is that Cambridge wine merchants now have a fantastic selection of ports for sale, with prices ranging from £65 to £120 a bottle.
The Pint Shop, which is opening on Pease Hill on the 4th of November, has published a sample menu so we know what to expect. And there are some really interesting combinations. For example, one starter includes mussels and smoked bacon, another potted beef with deep-fried walnuts. The mains include stuffed shoulder of lamb with Welsh onion cake, and I must give an honourable mention for a pudding, apple and damson pie, and anything with damson gets my vote. There are also charcoal spit roasts, braises and meats from the charcoal grill. It looks a great menu, and they've been hiring some top Cambridge chefs too.
I must say, Alan, I've never heard of a Welsh onion cake before. Well, I've spent a lot of time in Wales. I can only imagine it's something very economical. There's an onion, there's a cake, off you go. What you were saying just then sounds very meat-orientated. Is that just what you picked out?
Well, I think it is pretty meat-orientated, yes. There are a couple of vegetarian dishes and fish dishes, though. And you can sign up for a 33% discount opening offer from their website, which is pintshop.co.uk.
Does the menu remind you a bit of Fitzbillies?
Yes, and I think there's going to be some quite fierce competition. Fitzbillies has just rejuvenated their menu, though. And I would say they may be a bit cheaper than Pint Shop, and they now do breakfast at weekends.
Oh, cool. What sort of things?
Well, there's the full English, which I'm pleased to say includes black pudding, very Fitzbillies, and they do their own baked beans too. But if that doesn't appeal, there are some nice alternatives, such as granola with yoghurt and fruit compote. You can have baked egg with chorizo, or just toast and butter with preserves. No porridge, though, which I think is a shame. Fitzbillies has also introduced an evening feasting menu for families or groups.
Moving on to Inda's Kitchen now. They've just started their new autumn menu. There's some really interesting dishes on it, several of which are nut and gluten and dairy-free too in some cases. Now, one that really caught my eye was Kepalu Pulusu. I hope I pronounced that right. It's a spicy fish curry from Andhra Pradesh. It has a hot and sour sauce and is dairy, nut and gluten-free. So Inda's Kitchen, a very good website, and do check out their menu.
Any news from afternoon teas?
Yes, that's the new cafe opening up on King Street, and I haven't got a firm opening date for it yet. but I heard from Jo Krasinska this morning, and she's hoping it will open sometime during the third week in October. Much of the building work is complete, and it is beginning to look like a cafe. We'll tweet as soon as we hear a definite opening date. You can follow us for up-to-the-minute food and drink news on Twitter at Flavour105.
Join me, Phil Rowe, for Sunday breakfast from 8 for relaxing music, the legendary Cambridge Quiz, a review of the Sunday papers and interviews with local people. A great way to start your Sunday here on Cambridge 105, community radio in your city.
Right, and as we said, Tom Lewis is with us in the studio to give us some wines for October. The weather's warm at the moment, Tom.
Ish, cloudy, warm, bit mixed.
Yeah, so what are we going to get for October? What are you going to give us?
Well, I mean, for me, October is perhaps the most sort of confused temporal subdivision of the calendar. I mean, what other month gives you sort of late summer heat, damp autumnal chill and wintry darkness all in the same sort of 30-day period? It kind of doesn't know what's going on, really, which makes it interesting to a challenge to match with wines. Overall, to me, it's kind of a time of transition. It's when we're going from sort of summer to winter. It's also game season, so we want wines to match with that.
Right, so what suitable ones would you say there are?
Well, given that we're sort of transitioning from summer whites, that kind of means we want white wines coloured red. And what I mean by that is wines that are low in tannins and high in acidity. So they feel a bit like white wines, even if they have a red colour. For game, we want wines that have a bit of gaminess to them. The most obvious one is Pinot Noir. That's a very traditional match for darker game. But there are other wines that work well with game as well.
Right. Well, for those people who don't eat much game, how would you... I know this is a bit testing, really, yeah. But how would you describe gaminess?
What is gaminess?
Yeah.
It's sort of... It's difficult to describe if you've never had it before. I think if you have game, it has a very particular flavour. The sort of words I'd use to describe it, it's stronger, it's more animal, it's a bit sort of wild and undomesticated. So once you've had it, it's instantly recognisable, and perhaps the best way is to put it on a scale. Duck is perhaps the least gamey. If you've ever had hare... That's very gamey. That's sort of at the other end of the scale.
Right, I've not had hare, actually. But wines can taste gamey?
You can get some of that gamey character in a wine. Some of them have a distinctly sort of... It's either gaminess or a sort of vegetality. And again, the aromas, the words I'd use to describe them are something like either forest floor, wild mushrooms, or even something distinctly feral. And that works really well if you're matching it with a game dish, with the hare that you're going to have.
So I'm assuming that your comment about the vagaries of the weather will mean that there's a bit of a range this month. So what are you going to start with?
Yeah, I've got 5 wines this month, and I've kind of come up with a mood or a theme for each one of those. In the hope of some summer heat, I've started with a white. So my first one is for sunny days. It's the Orbayo Albariño from Rias Baixas. That's £10.49 from Bacchanalia. Geographically, we're in northwestern Spain, and this is made from the Albariño grape.
So does that make it similar to a light, Vino Verde from Portugal, since it's next door?
Indeed. It's the same grape. Geographically, it's a very similar region. It's probably a bit warmer here, so we're looking at something that's sort of bigger and fuller than a Vino Verde, but otherwise it's a very similar style of wine. The flavours are citrus fruit, melon skin. This is distinctly zesty. There's ripe pineapple in there, bit of yellow apricot, and the acidity is very fresh.
So it sounds quite characterful.
Definitely characterful. This wine itself has got a lot of exuberant personality.
So food matches?
In terms of food, I would match this with white fish, maybe quenelle in a creamy sauce, or chicken with morel mushrooms and a sherry sauce.
OK, so what sort of day is next?
Well, next sort of day I have in mind is chilly days, and this is where our guest wine comes in. This is from Beaujolais and beyond. It's the Domaine de la Plaine Régnier, which is in Beaujolais. This is the most recently recognised cru, the sort of highest designation for Beaujolais, and it graduated from a Beaujolais village in 1988. So this one is £11, and it's from Beaujolais and beyond.
I think Beaujolais is going through a bit of a hard time at the moment, isn't it?
I think it has had a sort of a bad reputation, the Beaujolais Nouveau kind of thing, sort of got overhyped and then sort of spoilt it. But it's sort of, you know, Beaujolais, it is a very good wine, fundamentally.
OK, well, let's spend a bit of time on Beaujolais wines on another programme.
For sure.
OK, because I think if their reputation is undeservedly bad, we ought to try and
resurrect it a little bit in people's estimation.
OK, but what's this wine like?
So like almost all Beaujolais, it's a red, and it's made from the Gamay grape, which is the red grape of Beaujolais. It's a relatively light wine, and for me, this has got a real old-world elegance and precision to it. In terms of the flavours, it's mainly cherry, so red and black cherry, with a bit of plum and damson fruit. And then the final thing is the acidity is quite prominent in it. It feels quite refreshing. I mean, I think it's a really lovely wine.
Okay. Is a good food wine being old?
I think it's a really versatile food match. It doesn't perhaps sing and dance quite as much as some of the other wines that we have this month, but that sort of focus and precision makes it a really good food match.
Right. And why is that?
I think what makes a good food wine is, in this, it's got plenty of acidity, and the tannins are low, and the fruit is very focused and pure. So it's kind of working like a squeeze of lemon juice on your fish. But it's also big enough to stand up to meat with a stronger sauce. So for me, something like a pan-fried duck breast with a cherry sauce would be a perfect match with this wine.
Yes, it sounds lovely. What about colder evenings?
So we'll definitely get some of those towards the end of the month, maybe even sooner. But for me, for a colder evening, what we need is something warming, which is the Sylvan Greenock Barossa Shiraz. That's £9.25 from Noel Young. This is made by Noel's business partner in his Magpie Estate venture, and it's a cancelled order that he managed to pick up on the cheap.
Right. Barossa is Australia, so New World style?
Indeed, very much a New World style here. It's warming, there's a slightly baked character to it, but there's enough acidity in there that keeps it all in check, so it's not a jammy wine at all. In terms of the flavour profile, it's characteristic Syrah. So there's lots of dark fruit, a bit of roasted spice, there's some sort of leatheriness to it. The texture is very soft. Interesting, there's something a bit port-like here. It's a bit sort of eucalyptusy or dried green herbs.
Right. And you could match that to, what, lamb with rosemary?
Perfect match for a wine like this.
OK, and your next wine is to match with roast dinners too,
yep.
I think.
Next one is for roast dinners, say lamb or beef, you know, with potatoes and root vegetables. It's La Vignetta Punch Apart. This is from Cambridge Wine Merchants, and it's $14.99.
OK, well, that's the most expensive so far. Is it the best so far?
It is the best, as you'd hope, from the most expensive. there is a correlation here. I think this is a really impressive wine. So it's a slightly unusual blend. It's Cabernet Sauvignon, which is not that common in Spain. Tempranillo is the big red grape there. And another one called Samso, which is the local name for the perhaps more familiar Carignan, which is southern French, northern Spain area. So why this is such a good wine? I mean, firstly, there's plenty going on in terms of flavours. There's sliced green bell peppers, pencil shavings, some dark plummy fruit and black cherry. Plus, there's some toasty oaky spiciness in there as well. So lots going on in terms of flavours. And that's the kind of thing that makes it interesting, enjoyable. But I think what takes it above that to the next level up technically is the structure, the quality of the underpinnings. So the acidity is really fresh and precise. The tannins are absolutely perfectly ripe. And it's got this long savouriness and a lovely inky texture.
Does sound good.
Yep, it's to me, it's really accomplished wine. Very good indeed.
Right, well, I hope the last wine isn't to come down after that one.
Well, hopefully not. For me, I think this one is really good as well. And this one's a bit quirky. It's from Joseph Barnes Wines. And Charles sort of rather specialises in bringing us wines that are not quite mainstream and often quite off the beaten track.
So what's unusual about this one then?
Well, what isn't unusual about a Fur Cervidoux from Marciac?
OK, can you explain? I think we're all a bit lost.
So Fur Cervidoux is the name of the grape. And Marciac is the region, and that's in southwest France. So my theme for this wine is days of mist and mellow fruitfulness. And what I have in mind here is kind of a bit of everything we've already talked about, really. Sort of, you know, kind of a day that's sunny, maybe a bit damp and misty and chilly, with a smell of decaying leaves in the air.
Right, well, I hope the wine is as good as your imagery. OK, give us the details, though, and tell us what it's like.
So the wine is by Jean-Luc Matta. It's called the Cuvée La Iris. It's a Marciac, as I said, and it's £11.50 from Joseph Barnes Wines. The grape variety, the Fur Cervidoux, fur in the name is actually a reference not to iron, but actually to a sort of slightly feral character that this grape has.
Oh, really? So does that mean it's sort of back to the gaminess that we talked
exactly
about?
There's a bit of gaminess to this. To me, this one is a little bit like a more characterful version of the Beaujolais that I was describing earlier. That had a sort of a purity and elegance. This is a sort of bit more of an interesting character. It's actually quite elusive. It's a little bit difficult to describe. I mean, there's sort of red fruits, a bit of wild strawberries and some sour cherries in there. And there's something unusual on the nose, a sort of slightly cabbagey, sulphurous tone.
Doesn't which sound too attractive, Tom.
Possibly not. Two things to say about that. Firstly, if you get that sort of slightly sulphurous whiff on the nose, that's often actually a sign of low added sulphur. It's the natural sulphurs, perhaps, in the grapes coming forward. So it's a sign of how well it's been made, because you need absolute cleanliness to be able to make a wine with low added sulphur. And if you still don't fancy the smell of it, well, again, it's only on the nose. It doesn't taste like it doesn't taste of rotten eggs. Don't worry, and it will dissipate with time or decrease a little bit. So don't be afraid to decant the wine. Obviously, the main action is on the palate, and that's where I think it's really good. It's very pure and precise. You know, unlike the Beaujolais and the Punchapart, it's very elegant. Lots of savouriness, and it just feels really well made. The flavours carry on the palate. They're red and black cherry, fruit, a bit of peppery spice, and this nice, fresh linear acidity with some soft tannins on the finish. So I think this is somehow it's late autumn in a glass. It's that combination of savouriness, vibrancy, and just a hint of decay coming in there. For food matches, I would match this with something gamey. And again, if you're going to try hare for the first time, I think that would be a great match for it.
Well, that sounds great. Sounds some really interesting wines.
Yeah, there's some lovely ones in there this month.
Okay, well, thanks, Tom.
Thanks, Tom. That's taken us up to 7 minutes till the hour.
Okay, let's have a quick look at the papers.
Okay.
And it's a big day for food in the papers, actually. The Financial Times has an autumn food special, and these are really worth looking at. This one's no exception at all. It features recipes from Heston Blumenthal's new book. Roly Lee has a piece on fungi. There's a review of what Nicholas Lander calls the most exciting meal of the year, and this was in what's judged to be the world's top restaurant. There's an article about cider making by Tim Haywood, and by the way, there's a cider festival at the Alexander Arms in Gwydir Street next weekend, and there's a piece about Middle Eastern snacks, and it's really good.
Isn't the top restaurant in Spain?
Yes, it is, in Girona, where I was for a couple of days last week.
Nice, and did you go to it?
Well, no. Apparently it gets 3,000 calls a day for tables, and there are no reservations for the foreseeable future.
And what was the food like? What did you try?
In Spain, well, it was extremely good. People talk about, Ruth talks about how good tapas can be, and if you go to the right places, it really is. We had some really excellent ones in Bilbao and San Sebastian. But okay, let's get back to the papers. Hugh Fearnley Whittingstall also has a new book coming out, and there are extracts in The Guardian's magazine. More about that in a moment if we've got time. Yotam Ottolenghi, also in The Guardian, has two books in preparation, actually, one being the Noppy cookbook, the recipes from his North of Piccadilly restaurant, and also in Cook there are in the Cook supplement there are apple recipes and autumn salads, a new feature on making the best uses of your spices, chutney recipes, and a very unusual nettle cocktail.
That sounds like something that Aoife Maxwell might be interested in.
Yes, I shall ask her. And Aoife, our cocktail correspondent, should be back on our next programme. I think I'll just wrap up with The Independent. The Independent's Mark Hicks's column is about chili. Mark's column differs from the Roly Lee and the Financial Times and the Guardian's columnists in that there's very little preamble, which is a shame, I think. But anyway, today's is about chili, so there's some nice combinations of it with other foods, and all three papers today have a wine column. So that's the papers for today.
Okay, well, thanks, Alan. That, of course, brings us to the end of another show.
Well, before it does, Matt, you and Ruth, I've got some sort of quite interesting developments in your lives, so and they affect the programme, really, which is why it's been mostly me recently. So let's give us a bit of explanation. Ruth, what have you been up to?
I've been doing an internship with a food publishing. It's not just food, they do not illustrated non-fiction, but really their strength at the moment is some really beautiful food cookbooks.
And are there so many coming up?
Oh, there's loads. So many beautiful ones. One came out in September that's called 7,000 Islands, and that's actually a Filipino cookbook, which you don't see
often.
I've
never seen a Filipino
exactly
cookbook.
I want to say that I have, but because I'm half Filipino, but I haven't.
Yeah.
And it's beautiful. And then my personal favourite that's coming out is called Treats. And it's from a food blogger in London. And it's like, basically, it's food things that you can give as gifts. So like really nice how to make these little truffles or beautiful little like cupcakes and things in a teacup. It's so cute.
Well, maybe you can bring some in and we can do a review or something.
Oh yeah, maybe.
We'll have to. Matt, what have you been doing anyway?
I've started a university course. I'm studying for a master's in radio now. So I've given up my job at Adam Brooks as an analyst, which I've been doing for the last 5 years or so.
That's pretty daring.
Yeah, I'm swapping numbers for words. The course, it started this week, and in that time, I just feel like I've stepped into another life. Yeah. Really.
And so have you learnt much in that week?
Yes, an awful lot. It's very, very daunting. It's very intimidating, but I think it's perfect to be scared at this point. I'm being taught by screenwriters, producers, journalists, documentary makers. Yeah. I'm being schooled in the technical aspects of radio production by a man who's been working for the World Service for the last 18 years. I'm doing media law and ethics, shorthand, voice presentation, the full multimedia song and dance of today. And we've got to write with precision, with elegance, editorial judgment, where we want to get the best content, the best use of time to produce the most stimulating and entertaining radio.
But as far as the technical side of production is concerned, I mean, you do the production for Flavour, and it seems to me you do a really good job. I mean, is there much to learn?
I think there's an awful lot to learn, because we do have an awful lot of buttons and sliders and faders.
Actually, we were saying before we didn't know what some of them were for.
Exactly. I get the impression that we do something along the lines of the bare minimum to make ourselves sound professional, but there's an awful lot more fine-tuning that is involved and that we can take advantage of to really produce something lovely. Like fine-tuning a car, and that's what I really want to get down to the nuts and bolts of.
Right, it'll help us write more interesting scripts, perhaps.
I think they're very interesting already, but yes, we're all dedicated here.
Right, well, perhaps you can both let us know from time to time how things are going.
Certainly will.
And perhaps our listeners can let us know if they think the programme's improving.
Well, don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Flavour105. Now, that's where you will read about the news that we discover ourselves, and we'll also be retweeting food and drink stories from other Cambridge sources. The next live edition of Flavour will be going out on Saturday, the 19th of October at midday, and you can find our previous episodes on our podcast page on the Cambridge 105 website.
Do join us next time. Coming up next is Saturday Lunch, which features Mr. Cake, actually.
Yes, it does.
Okay. Well,
bye.
Goodbye.
Bye.